Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. And our guest this hour is Dar Jamel. He is from originally Anchorage, Alaska. And he has gone to Iraq in order to bring back stories that we don't get to see on the cable news channels. He writes for Interpress Service and Antiwar.com and his website, DarJamelIraq.com. His reports have also been published in The Nation, The Sunday Herald, Islam Online, and many others around the world. He also does radio for Flashpoints, the British Broadcasting Company, and Democracy Now. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks for having me.
And where are you now, in Baghdad?
Right, central Baghdad.
How long have you been in Iraq?
Well, this trip, I've been back a little bit over 2 weeks now, but over the last 11 months, I've spent about 6 months here.
And this is your third trip to Iraq, correct?
That's correct.
I read something that you wrote, I guess, on your first day back on your third trip, where you talked about how the mood on the street and kind of the feeling in the air was different each of the three times that you've gone back there. Can you explain a little bit what you mean about that?
Yes, it was roughly this time last year that I came to Iraq my first time, and it was November 24th, 2003. And that trip, for the 9 weeks I was here, of course it was dangerous, of course it was tense, but I was still able to work with other journalists, going around together in cars, covering different stories together with other journalists from different countries, for example. And we could walk down the streets during the day, and that was okay. We could go out to eat at restaurants, and that was okay. The threat of kidnapping wasn't even really on the radar screen. But then the last trip, which was April, May, and June of this year, all that changed. The threat of kidnapping was very real. It was very dangerous to go outside, but I was still able to get out basically on a daily basis. It morphed to a point where it was only safe to go with one Westerner, with an Iraqi interpreter in a car, and that's it, and be very wary about where we went. And there were definitely certain areas of the country that at that point it was definitely not safe to go.
And that was the beginning of the last summer.
I'm sorry?
That was at the beginning of last summer.
That's right, exactly. It was April, May, and June of this summer. And then this trip, by even comparison to that, Iraq is yet again a different country. It's, I'm not getting out that much. I'm only getting out, about every other day, which I really am not happy about, but that's the circumstances we find ourselves here, where the threat of kidnapping is extremely real. There's well over a car bomb a day going off in Baghdad now. There's heavy fighting literally in the streets of different parts of Baghdad every single day. It's just extremely, extremely dangerous. Walking down the street is definitely an act of taking one's life in your hands. It's just extremely tense here now. For Westerners, it's really, really difficult to work here and dangerous for anyone to go out, actually, and even including Iraqis.
You've written that the 70% unemployment rate has made kidnapping the growth industry in Iraq these days.
Yeah, it's pretty dark humor, but unfortunately it's true. Criminal gangs have capitalized on it, and what's going on in Iraq now is basically similar to what was happening in Lebanon during the war in Beirut, where criminal gangs are kidnapping any foreigner they can get their hands on, and then just selling them on up the food chain.
It's the Weekend Interview Show. We'll be right back with Dar Jamel, live from Baghdad, the Republic Broadcasting Network. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The guest is Dar Jamel. He's an American reporter in Baghdad right now. He writes for Interpress Service and Antiwar.com. His own website is DarJamailIraq.com, DarJamailIraq.com. And the last couple of weeks have seen the re-invasion of Fallujah by American troops and their Iraqi collaborators. So my question to you, sir, is now that the crushing has been accomplished, have the terrorists gotten the message?
Well, the crushing is not accomplished, and the majority of the fighters in Fallujah were not terrorists. While there was some, there is some terrorist organizations operating in Iraq now that the borders have been wide open since the invasion. The majority of the people in Fallujah were people there defending their city and defending their homes because they did not want to be occupied. But as we can see by the number of attacks, going simply on the Department of Defense's own numbers, since the attack on Fallujah by the military, there's been a drastic increase in resistant attacks on the U.S. military throughout Iraq. In fact, in one day alone in Baghdad recently, we had 66 attacks on the U.S. military only in Baghdad in one day. So this is what mission accomplished Fallujah looks like in Iraq.
So for our military victory, we get political failure.
Political failure, loss of U.S. soldier lives, soldiers being wounded, maimed for life, and loss of countless Iraqi lives all across Iraq on a daily basis. This is the result of what's happened in Fallujah. It is continuing to grow exponentially worse, and the resistance is spreading as we speak.
By now, most people have seen the footage of the Marine murdering his captive in a mosque in Fallujah last Saturday. And there's a website called Link TV where they run a summary of the news in the Arab world. And that Marine and that execution seem to be all they're talking about over there. Is that right?
Without a doubt. That film has been showed on all of the Arab media constantly since it occurred. And not just that actual film clip of him shooting the one unarmed wounded man in the mosque, but there's a longer version. That same footage shot by the same cameraman actually filmed the execution of three people in that very same mosque, and that's what's being run over and over here. It's basically what we have is another PR disaster on par with the Abu Ghraib scandal. Any credibility that the U.S. military may have had left here after 19 months of failed occupation, that credibility is gone.
Is there any proportion of the people of Iraq that see American forces as liberators?
It's roughly the same proportion of people in America who benefit under the Bush administration, the top 1%. The top 1% of Iraqis, the people who came in out of exile along with the invaders, who are now profiting on the destruction of their own country. This roughly 1% of Iraqis are happy to see Americans here because it's people who are getting their pockets lined by the occupation. But finding anyone outside of that 1% who is in support of this occupation is difficult, if not impossible.
Well, you know, there's lots of bad news all the time because you know, if it bleeds, it leads, and that sort of thing. But what about all the good news, the schools, the electricity, the sewage, the local economy, that kind of thing?
that is really included in the bad news. The photo ops that the military has put out there for the few reschools that have been rebuilt or Bechtel are basically propaganda, because the reality is, the vast majority of the schools, I would say conservatively 80% of the schools lie in disrepair. Water treatment plants, I've written in-depth investigative reports on the situation of the water treatment plants under the Bechtel contract. Most of them have not even been touched. the electricity. I am in, right now I am in central Baghdad in one of the better areas of the city for electricity, and we average about between 8 and 10 hours a day of national electricity. The rest of the time we're on the generators. We have an ongoing fuel crisis where lines at the pump here in oil-rich Iraq are upwards of 3 to 5 miles long. There are entire cities that don't have any petrol at all. Infrastructure here is in complete shambles and worsening as the occupation grinds on, and none of these reconstruction promises by Western corporations are being fulfilled.
The Red Cross says that at least 800 civilians were killed in the recent reinvasion of the city of Fallujah, and the British medical journal Lancet 2 weeks ago reported that when they compare the death rates from before the war with since, that if you include all the violence of local crime and kidnapping and add to that all the people killed by the United States, they say 100,000 people who would have been alive today are now dead. And so the question I have at the end of that little speech is whether you believe America will ever be forgiven, or whether we have just recruited an entire generation of young people into the jihadist camp against us.
Well, we certainly have turned the majority of Iraq that was happy when Saddam was overthrown have effectively been turned 100% against the United States. The anti-American sentiment here now is really, it's difficult to bear. It's really an incredible thing to see, and it's completely justified, having had their country decimated. And just another angle on that statistic, Saddam Hussein, in 24 years of rule as a brutal dictator, was directly responsible for the deaths of 300,000 Iraqis, not millions, as some of the right-wing propagandists like to say. That's a complete lie. It's 300,000. And the U.S. military, directly or indirectly, in 19 months of occupation, has killed at least at least 100,000 Iraqis. It's really a dismal comparison. But if people want to understand why this is such a failed occupation and why the vast, vast majority of Iraqis are vehemently opposed to the U.S. being in their country now, that's why.
Well, and especially, you know, you take that 300,000 number and you recognize the fact that when he killed all those Kurds, that was at the behest of the American government during the war against Iran. And then all the Shia that were killed in 1991 after the United States government, our current president's father, told them to go ahead and rise up against Saddam Hussein and that we would back them up. And then in a Bay of Pigs-style maneuver, we left them high and dry. That's probably where most of the 300,000 comes from, no?
That's a really good point, actually. And those numbers and the responsibility that those massacres lie on, being the United States government, is certainly not lost on Iraqis, who, comparatively to the majority of Americans, read the news in depth, analyze it critically, and know very well that both of those incidents, the United States government is behind them and responsible for those deaths as well. So that's a very good point.
Much is made of the presence of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in Iraq, but it seems like he should be dead 20 times over by now with all the safe houses that have been bombed. Is he even still alive, or is he just a great boogeyman?
That is a really good question. It certainly remains unanswered. And the bottom line is there's been no proof from the U.S. government or from the military here that this person even exists. ABC News even reported that he had been killed in March. Yet now they've conveniently resurrected his name and like to broadcast it pretty much every time they discuss Iraq. So most people here don't even believe this person exists. They believe he's a CIA-manufactured propaganda tool similar to how bin Laden was used to bomb and then occupy Afghanistan. Now we have Zarqawi, created in the aftermath of lack of weapons of mass destruction, being used to justify the bombing, aerial bombing and artillery bombing of entire cities such as Fallujah. And now this is starting to occur in Ramadi or Samarra. So one joke on the streets here is, wonder which city Zarqawi will pop in next so the U.S. can bomb it.
It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The guest is Dar Jamail. He's an American reporter. We're talking to him live from Baghdad. You wrote a shocking column yesterday about a raid on a mosque where someone inside the mosque called you on the cell phone in the middle of it. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, my interpreter actually was in the Abu Hanifa Mosque in the Al-Adamiyah district of Baghdad for Friday prayers. We were taking the day off, as we do every Friday, so, because it's Friday in Islam is roughly the equivalent of Sundays for Christian. It's a church day. It's a day to be spent with family. It's a day to rest and relax and have some fun and share a good meal. And so he was just finishing his Friday prayers in Abu Hanifa Mosque, and the mosque was surrounded and sealed by U.S. troops along with Iraqi National Guard collaborators. And they descended upon the mosque in order to detain the imam, who's been a very outspoken
occupation. I'm going to have to ask you to hold that thought. We're about to go out to a break, and we'll finish up that story when we get back. It's the Weekend Interview Show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. Our guest this hour is Dar Jamail. He's an American reporter in Baghdad. You can read what he writes at Interpress Service, which is, I believe it's IPS.org, and also he writes for antiwar.com. And you might as well read everything at antiwar.com while you're at it. Okay, so when we went out to the break, Dar, you were telling us the story of a phone call you received yesterday from someone inside a mosque being raided by American soldiers.
Yes, my interpreter, Abu Talat, was in the mosque, and I was sitting on my computer writing, and my cell phone rang, and it was him, and in the background was this deafening yelling of thousands, what sounded like thousands of people in a confined area, praying extremely loudly, and it was a frantic, chaotic scene. And he was yelling at me what was happening. He said, "Dar, I am in my mosque, and we're being surrounded by soldiers, and now they're holding us at gunpoint," and then the phone would hang up. And then so I just started writing down what was happening. I could barely believe it. And he called back a few minutes later, and he said, "Okay, I'm trying to call so that they can't see me talking to you, but you have to know what's going on. You have to get this out. They've just shot and killed four people and shot and wounded at least nine others." And then the phone would go down, and then he would call back again and give me more reports, and that's essentially how we filed a lot of the story of while it was in progress. Also, he had a little tape recorder that we used to conduct interviews with people, a little mini cassette recorder in his pocket, so he just pushed play once the raid began, and we taped the entire thing, so we have actually the gunshots and people being killed on tape.
How many people were killed?
There were four people killed and at least nine wounded by soldiers inside the mosque. It was actually inside the mosque that these unarmed people who were there praying were shot and killed simply because they sealed the mosque to detain the imam, which they did. Then when they left, they took 30 unarmed people with them. They detained them for unknown reasons. So these people have essentially been disappeared. Of course, when I tried to contact the military spokesperson here in Baghdad and requested information on what was the purpose of killing these people, of course, they essentially gave me a no comment.
Wonderful. I guess it doesn't really deserve much of a comment if you're the guilty party. What are you going to say?
Well, this is the standard operating procedure of the military here, and it has been for a long time. This mosque gets raided on a repeated basis, And going into a mosque, it is a war crime. Going into a mosque, any place of worship, when there's no fighters there, there's no weapons whatsoever, it's yet another war crime in what is becoming an endless list of war crimes committed by the military here.
Well, I'd like to just go ahead and give you an opportunity to address the Nuke Fallujah crowd who thinks that the problem here is that we just haven't shown enough brute force yet, and that once we do, the problems will all be under control and these people will finally submit to our overwhelming force, and then everything after that will be great. So I know that's the opinion. I know you know that that's the prevailing opinion in many places here in the United States. So I'd just like to give you this opportunity to answer that kind of thing however you like.
Well, I think the proof is on the ground here in Iraq, as well as the rest of the world, as far as the effects of this policy. If we look at it logically and reasonably, as far as has this been a success or not, let's start with the war on terrorism. Between 1991 and 2001, there were three major international terrorist attacks in the world in those 10 years. Since Bush declared his war on terror from basically 9/11, 2001 until now, there's been 17 major terrorist attacks around the world. So this is the effects of the war on terror. We see a micro version of that in Iraq. Let's look at just Fallujah, for example, to stay in the present moment here. Since the attack on Fallujah, there have been well over 100 attacks per day. Per day, that's over one every 15 minutes on U.S. soldiers here. Most of the time, these result in, at the very least, a wounded soldier, and we're averaging per day now well over three dead U.S. soldiers and well over 20 to 30, well over 20 wounded per day. So it's actually over 23 wounded per day. So this is there's been a sharp escalation in resistance attacks on U.S. military and Iraqi National Guard and Iraqi police collaborators since Fallujah, on a level that was unheard of just even prior to the siege of Fallujah. So what we see in common here is that while the mighty hammer of the U.S. military, and it is the mightiest hammer of a military ever to be on planet Earth, every time it falls, inevitably the violent resistance that rises up to resist against it and strikes back is usually five times what existed before that hammer fell. So if we keep on with this policy, the military will continue to wreak death and destruction wherever it lands.
It's the weekend interview show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. We'll be right back. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. That's where I keep all the archives of my previous interviews. So if you're just tuning into this one, you're definitely going to want to go back in a day or two and hear the whole thing. Interviewing Dar Jamail. He writes for Interpress Service and Antiwar.com. His own website is darjamailiraq.com. And he's an American reporter in Baghdad right now. You know what I wanted to ask you was, have you ever been embedded with the U.S. military? You seem, all your columns seem to, or articles seem to kind of express the Iraqi point of view. I wonder if you ever travel around with the Marines and report on the situation from their side.
I've never actually embedded, but I have had the opportunity to talk with troops as I run into them when I go out in the field, because you can't really go anywhere here without at least going through a checkpoint or being a military operation of some sort going on. So I've never embedded. I don't believe in it, but I have definitely gone out of my way to try to talk with troops.
Well, and what do they say to you? I mean, do they believe that they're here getting vengeance for 9/11, or what is it? How do they justify their own actions to themselves?
Well, some do, of course, but most of the folks I spoke with, they seemed to be more the National Guard types in the reserves, not the enlisted types. So they seemed to be basically just trying to survive, keeping a stiff upper lip. Their opinions and their morale depends totally on how long they've been here. I've talked to people who've just been here a couple of months, and they're still saying, yes, we're trying to help Iraqis, and they're still basically spewing the propaganda. And then folks that I talk to that have been here 9, 10 months, a year, they're either stoned or walking around aiming their guns at everyone. They just don't care anymore. They're unafraid to kill anything that moves, and their attitude is, well, it's better that they died than me. I just need to get the hell out of here. The morale is very low, and I learned rather quickly not to try to make small talk by asking them, well, when are you going to get out of Iraq, you know, when you get to go back home, because that was usually met with the response of, don't ask that question, because every time we get a leave date, it gets changed at the last minute.
Well, a lot has been made about the elections coming up in January, and that if, in fact, that was the excuse, I believe, for the reinvasion of Fallujah in the last couple of weeks, was we have to take control over the Sunni Triangle to provide security so that people will feel that it's a free and fair election that they can go and vote in. And yet, at the same time, there are stories here and there about different imams and leaders throughout Iraq urging their followers to boycott the election. So I wonder, what do you think needs to happen in order for the January elections to take place in a way that is satisfying to most of the people in Iraq?
Well, everyone is demanding a ceasefire for the U.S. military to go to their bases and stay there. This is not going to happen. We've had 47 political parties now that have boycotted the elections. We've had members in the interim government that have withdrawn in protest of the military operations, not just in Fallujah, but all around the country. If these elections that are scheduled for January 27th even occur then, I'll be very, very surprised. We have political parties dropping on a daily basis out of this election idea. And if they occur at all, it's going to be most likely February or March. It's just one more arbitrary date that the U.S. has drawn in the sand. If they occur in January, it will be a minor miracle, and if they occur, it will most certainly be an absolute debacle and a bloodbath.
Is anybody even running besides Alawi?
No. In fact, no one will announce that they are officially a candidate because everyone's well aware that once they do, they're a dead man, or dead woman. So, no, essentially right now, no. No names have been thrown in the hat for fear of reprisal.
We haven't heard much news out of Najaf in a while. How are things going down there with al-Sadr? I hear he's forming a political party.
He is. Sadr is very much opposed to what's been happening in Fallujah and basically remains defiant against the U.S. occupation. I fully expect there to be fighting with the Sadr's, Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army once again. And the situation in Najaf is grim, and people are extremely angry because Alawi and the U.S. military promised to help rebuild there, as did Ambassador John Negroponte. And the city lies in ruins. It was destroyed not nearly on the level that we see Fallujah destroyed, but it is destroyed, and there's been no help in rebuilding and reconstruction there.
When the U.S. government finally does leave Iraq, do you think it's likely that Iraqi nationalism will be forceful enough to override the ethnic tensions between the Kurds, the Sunni, and the Shia, or will the different tribes fight over the central government?
I think without a doubt there will be conflict. I think that that's the nature of this region. It's the legacy. There will without a doubt be a power struggle, as there already is to some extent. The pervading opinion remains that the Arabic proverb comes to light, which is me against my brother, me and my brother against my cousin, me and my brother and my cousin against the stranger. So right now the United States is the stranger in Iraq, and all of the different sects are fighting, excluding the Kurds, that is, all of them are fighting right now together to get the occupier out of their country.
Well, and you mentioned the Kurds. That's really the big sticking point. From what I understand, the town of Kirkuk is now a Kurdish town, but has historically been a Sunni town, and that if the Kurds don't have Kirkuk, then they don't have any oil at all. And the Sunnis, I guess, even though they're the smallest ethnic minority, they have all the valuable real estate, right?
That's true. And Kirkuk is the Kurdish situation, both in Kirkuk and throughout the north, is going to be a very interesting thing to watch because they are essentially going independent now. Turkey is vehemently opposed to this, even though they are a so-called ally of the U.S., and they've openly said that if the Kurds try to go independent, they will invade Kurdistan and do whatever they have to do to keep that from happening. Kirkuk, there are extreme tensions between the Kurds, the Arabs, and the Turkmen there, and its lines are being drawn in the sand, and there's political assassinations on a weekly basis there, and many, many attacks up there consistently on Iraqi police, National Guard, and the military. So it's extremely volatile part of the equation.
Would it be going too far to say that the United States has already lost this war?
Not at all. In fact, it wouldn't have gone too far to say that 6 months ago, even before Abu Ghraib and Fallujah, this occupation was lost, due in large part to the empty, unfulfilled promises of rebuilding and reconstruction made by the government and the Western corporations. And then the other factor is due primarily to the relentlessly heavy-handed tactics of the U.S. military here, hearkening back to what you talked about earlier, citing that 100,000 dead statistic.
Yeah, it seems in all these articles, there are many direct quotes of locals in Iraq who basically seem to just be expressing complete exasperation and sort of hopelessness as they really don't know what to do. They don't really have the power to fight back. They don't seem, many of the people you talk to, it doesn't seem like they want to join the Mujahideen, but they sure don't want to be occupied by America indefinitely.
That's right. And in fact, most people, though, now will say, well, maybe I'm not with the Mujahideen, but I support them. I would give them money. I would give them food. I would give them shelter. And the bottom line is the U.S. military, in their heavy-handed tactics, and then using the interim government to, they, for example, banned demonstrations, they've left the people here with no other opportunity to effect change in Iraq other than the violent resistance.
That's sort of an interesting phenomenon. I read somewhere about really the creation of Al-Qaeda and how really it was, the fact was all the oppression in Saudi Arabia where people were not allowed to express any sort of political discontent anywhere except the mosque. That's the only place where they still had freedom of speech. And so you had everyone who was a political radical going and radicalizing the mosque while the mosque is kind of adding religious indoctrination to their politics. And we end up creating a monster, whereas if we just let these people have a debate out in public in the first place, it might have never gone the way it went.
That's a good point, and that's exactly what's happening here in Iraq, a country that Saddam Hussein even went to great lengths to keep completely secular. Now we have this dramatic escalation of religious fundamentalism, which for the most part was not here before. In the part, the small areas where it did exist, it was definitely kept under wraps. Now we see a dramatic increase. In fact, and there's even villages now in parts of Iraq where women are wearing not just the abaya, but the burqa, the full cover as they are in Afghanistan. So we're seeing that exact same phenomena now occurring in Iraq, and it's spreading.
So here was a country where women could drive, they could wear Western clothes, they could have PhDs, and they could be medical doctors, they could own their own property, and now they're wearing burqas since America's invasion.
This is exactly true. This is the freedom.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I'm glad that our government's Wilsonian nation-building projects always go off without a hitch. You know, it's funny, I was reading about the original 14 points and Woodrow Wilson and the Make the World Safer Democracy. One of his original 14 points was to create an independent Kurdistan. Those poor Kurds, they're tired of being ruled by the Ottomans and the Turks and the Sunni and the Shia. It's time for them to have their own sovereign independent nation. That was 80 years ago.
That is really incredible. I didn't know that, actually. That's really stupendous. And now the U.S. government wonders why the Kurds are going to go ahead and go independent, even though it's one of the sticking factors of them not having independence now that the U.S. has, quote-unquote, liberated Iraq, is that the U.S. government will not allow it, simply because of the other political ramifications it would send out across this region, i.e. Turkey, Israel, and Iran. So it's, once again, the Kurds find themselves in this untenable situation.
Yeah, it's most unfortunate. I'm sorry, cell phone's ringing in my pocket, distracting me for a second there. You wrote an interesting article about media repression in liberated Iraq, and brought to my attention the fact that Al Jazeera hasn't been allowed in Iraq in months. Oh, did we lose him? Oh, man, we lost our connection with Dar Jamil. Well, anyway, yeah, he wrote this great article called Media Repression in Liberated Iraq. Let's see if we can get him back on the phone. We got wonderful Paul Martin, the engineer, trying to get us reconnected with Dar Jamil. If you're just tuning in, Dar Jamil is an American reporter who's in Baghdad right now. He writes for antiwar.com and the Interpress Service. I strongly recommend you read what he writes. This is a terrible situation. It really looks like the kind of thing where American intervention here has created what will apparently be unforeseen consequences for probably decades. And like he mentioned, the Turks absolutely will not tolerate an independent Kurdistan. Why? Well, because there's a lot of ethnic Turks in Turkey. Ethnic Kurds in Turkey. And the Turkish government has been repressing them quite violently for a very long time. And if Kurdistan becomes a sovereign nation in its own right, then the Kurds in Turkey are going to want to join. And that creates a big problem for our ally for the last 50 years, Turkey. So we're going to have unintended consequences flowing from this invasion for quite some time. And now, Dar, do we have you back on the line here?
Yeah, sure do. We just got a taste of the liberated phone lines here in Iraq.
Oh, yes. Is that government work that set up that phone system there?
Yeah, you betcha.
Yeah, no libertarians in this military. So Kurdistan. This is really the big sticking point, isn't it? The Turks are not going to tolerate an independent Kurdistan. But I have an idea. Actually, it's not mine, but Ivan Elin from the Independent Institute suggested that if aside from just packing up all our stuff and leaving immediately, if we want to leave Iraq in with any form of legitimacy at all, that perhaps maybe a tactic that might work would be to create a very weak central government so that Iraq maintains its national identity and so forth, but where the Kurds, the Sunni, and the Shia basically would be in separate states with quite a bit of autonomy, as the Kurds have enjoyed for the last 10 years or so, as they were protected by the American no-fly zones and such like that. Do you think that could work, or is it the whole thing's just going to fall apart as soon as we leave anyway?
No, I don't think that'll work. Iraq's an extremely interesting and complex puzzle. Even though there is no love lost between the Kurds and the Sunni, there remains this extremely strong nationalism to keep Iraq one nation. And then, of course, there would be disputes over things like you alluded to earlier with oil. And the same with the Shia and the Sunni, although there's really not that big of a rift between those two sects as the U.S. mainstream media likes to continually portray.
Really?
The bottom line is there will be fighting, there will be troubles, there will be a massive period of instability if the U.S. left. But I think it's all a moot point, because the reality is the U.S. military already has 4 permanent bases in Iraq. The reality is There's no way at this point, because of the billions of dollars spent and lost already on this war, which is now costing over $5 billion a week, the amount of lives lost, both Iraqi and U.S. soldier, it's an investment that the Bush administration has made that for them to pull out at this point would be admitting to the world defeat, and this seems like something the Bush administration has been incapable of doing from the very start.
Yeah, well, you definitely got that right. I just wish they'd declare victory and go home, but maybe it's too late. It's a weekend interview show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show, wrapping up for November 20th, 2004. I'm your host, Scott Horton. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com, where we keep all the archives of previous interviews. So if you missed the show today, definitely go to weekendinterviewshow.com in the next day or two. We'll have the archives of both of today's interviews up there. My guest this hour is Dar Jamail. He writes for Interpress Service and Antiwar.com. His own website is DahrJamailIraq.com. Dar Jamail Iraq.com. And welcome back to the show, sir.
Thanks, Scott.
You wrote this article. Well, I'm not sure which one to pick on you for now. Either dogs eating bodies in the streets of Fallujah, which is absolutely horrifying result of American policy, or if you like, you could address media repression in liberated Iraq.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about. There's so much to talk about here, but I'll stick. Everyone knows that the atrocities are continuing to unfold in Fallujah. Well, I'm assuming that anyhow, or has at least heard of it, but. One that people may not be as aware of is the media repression here. One of the first things the U.S. installed interim government did, for example, was ban Al Jazeera from reporting in Baghdad for a month. It's because Al Jazeera has consistently done an extremely good job of showing the true effects of the occupation and what's happening on the ground here. Shortly thereafter, that one-month ban has been extended indefinitely and remains that way today. And then even just a few days ago, U.S. installed Prime Minister Alawi made a public announcement that any Al Jazeera journalist continuing to work on in Iraq, if found, would be detained. They have actually let out releases during the Fallujah fighting that said any media organization not talking the government line concerning these operations will be punished. This is the free media and free speech in occupied Iraq, a place where more journalists have been killed by the U.S. military in the last 18 months than any other area of the world by any other military or terrorist organization on the planet. So this is the media situation here. It's really... to call it Orwellian is not a stretch by any means. It's really an amazing thing to watch, and it's an extremely difficult situation to try to work under.
Well, and not just being hypocritical, which obviously it is, America coming to liberate you and shut down your local media, but it's also quite counterproductive. If memory serves, it was when American forces shut down Muqtada al-Sadr's newspaper that Najaf exploded in rebellion.
That's exactly right. And just as with any repression at any time, you can repress a people for a while, but in the end, it's going to end up causing them to fight against you that much harder. That's exactly what happened with Sadr. That's exactly what we're seeing in Fallujah. And that's exactly what we're seeing throughout Iraq. It's as if every quote-unquote U.S. solution that is applied to a problem has this amazing tendency here to create 10 more problems that end up being worse than far worse than the initial one that they attempted to fix in the first place.
All right, Dar Jamel, thank you very much, not just for coming on the show, but thank you for your bravery in staying over there in Iraq to tell us these stories. Everybody, please read Dar Jamel and what he writes for Interpress Service and AntiWar.com. And thank you again, sir, for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.